Welcome to Guitar Radio Show, the show dedicated to the guitar player, guitar maker, gear builder, and purveyors of such items that you may not know about, but should. Here's your host, Mark Davin.
All right, folks, welcome back to another episode of Guitar Radio Show. We have a returning guest, someone that I'm friends with, and I love her work. She's an amazing photographer, a huge music lover, and now a guitar player, I understand, as well. I'll want to talk about her guitar in a little bit. She has a book that she has been planning for a while. Matter of fact, when she was with us last time, she was actually in the works, and the book is coming out in April of 2020, and it's called "Seeing Stevie Ray Vaughan." "Seeing Stevie Ray." I want to say Vaughan all the time. And we welcome back to the show, Tracy Ann Hart. Welcome back, Tracy.
Thank you. I would hardly call myself a guitar player. You know, having a guitar and an amp doesn't necessarily qualify you, but, you know.
Well, it's a nice looking Strat, though.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, it is.
Do you get to play much or no?
No, I haven't lately. No.
This book has been a labor of love for you for many years, and matter of fact, really going all the way back to the early 80s, right?
Well, you mean the book itself?
Well, not the book itself, but I mean, that's where the pictures all came from, and, you know, throughout the years.
Many of them, yeah, started in the early 80s, especially you got Joe Ely and 1981 and Jimmy Vaughan 1982 and then Stevie in 1983.
Right. So hey folks, to find out more about Tracy, go to theheightsgallery.com. That link will be in the show notes at guitarradioshow.com if you're listening somewhere else and any of those other multitude of outlets that we broadcast on. Go to guitarradioshow.com and you can find that link, theheightsgallery.com, and you can get a whole bunch more information about Tracy, about the book, and about an exhibit that she's going to have on March 14th, 2020, Photo Fest exhibit at Antiquarium Gallery in Houston, Texas. So for all you folks in H-Town, or if you're going to be in H-Town on March 14th, you can go and check out that exhibit. What do we expect? Is it going to be, you're going to be highlighting, obviously, a lot of the photos from the book, correct?
Right, yes. That's a great deal of what it is. And we're going to have a few advanced copies of the book for sale and to be signed.
Oh,
and
cool.
And also, you know, several large archival prints and so on. So it'll be good. And the exhibit itself will be up through April 19th. So, you know, if you're in Houston anytime during that month, you should definitely stop by. The gallery is on West Gray in the River Oaks Shopping Center.
Very cool. Very cool. I was lucky enough to be one of the people that got to see your showing here in Austin a couple of years ago, and I got to buy a reprint, which was thrilling, and you signed it for me. It's hanging right here in the studio. If I just turn my head just slightly, there it is. And I absolutely love it. It's the first thing I see when I walk in the room every day, so it's super cool. Tell us a little bit about the folks that wrote the foreword for this book. You had three amazing guitar players who I respect incredibly, two of which I've had on the show. Tell us a little bit about that those forewords.
Okay. Well, what I really wanted to do for the forewords was have someone who was a contemporary of Stevie's, and that's David Grissom, and someone with a totally different perspective, who grew up in a different country, but was also a big fan of Stevie's, and that's Nollie Colt of Vintage Trouble. And then I wanted to get somebody who grew up listening to Stevie through older recordings and so on, who's an amazing Freudian slip. He's not a photographer. He's a guitar player and musician in his own right, and that's Eric Tesmer. And yeah, his just the respect and love that he has for Stevie is you can hear it in his playing, and you can definitely read it in what he wrote.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. The first time you saw Stevie was March of 83. That's correct?
Yes.
And that was that at Rockefeller's?
No, actually, that was at Fitzgerald's.
Oh, at Fitzgerald's. Okay.
Yeah.
And the photos from that are just phenomenal. You did this kind of and once again, I'm not a photographer, but I love this particular effect that photographers do with the film or the exposure, where it kind of looks like the image is vibrating, so to speak.
Oh, the ambient light. Yeah, it gives you a sharp center image, but it still shows motion.
Right.
And I think I've compared that to feedback on the guitar.
That's excellent.
You can do it in a real wild way, or you can control it, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's just basically, it's called dragging the shutter, which is what gives you that effect with using a flash and a slow shutter speed.
That's an excellent analogy. It's like feedback for the photo. Yeah, that's super cool. The very first time I ever saw that and was so taken by that was the album cover for Jeff Beck's Wired record. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
that, I don't think that's not quite the same technique. That's without a flash, but that, yeah, it's very similar.
Yeah.
With that, you actually... the way it was done on the Jeff Beck cover, you actually move the camera a little bit. At a very slow shutter speed as well.
Oh, very cool. Okay. That's easy. I'm learning something new. Okay, cool. I've always been fascinated with photography, but sort of like what you said in our last interview, you know, if you would have had guitars lying around the house, you probably would have been a guitar player, but you had cameras lying around the house, right? Because of your dad?
Right, yeah, because my dad was a professional photographer.
So I totally get it. I'm always enamored by this particular art form because of what you capture, you know. And there are pictures that you've taken over the years of, you know, Stevie and Jimmy Vaughn and the Bramholes, both Doyle Senior and the second. And Charlie Sexton and Joe Ely, and I mean the list goes on and on of all the folks that you've taken photos of that are now have become almost stock photography in our brains for guitar players. A lot of times I've been with friends of mine and we're looking at a picture and something and I go, hey, I know who took that picture. And you're one of the few people I can say that about, and it's would you say it's really just about being in the right place at the right time and catching the moment? Is that really what it comes down to?
Well, you have to be in the right place at the right time, but it's also you have to know when the right time is, and you have to, you know, have the technical knowledge to be able to capture it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, for sure. You had mentioned in the book that in your estimation, and I have to agree with you, that there might not have been a Stevie Ray Vaughan had there not been a Jimmy Vaughan to light that fire.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, I would say, you know, for sure that Jimmy Vaughan was Stevie's biggest influence, because, you know, here's this older brother who he looks up to and respects and admires, and this guy picks up the guitar, and Jimmy I'm referring to, and he's just a natural, and, you know, even at a very early age, he becomes a very respected guitar player. And then when he moved to Austin, you know, it's like, oh wow, it's Jimmy Vaughn, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, and you know, without that influence and without Jimmy's guitars lying around, and the records that Jimmy brought home, like some of the Jimi Hendrix records and so on, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, I'm sure eventually Stevie would have found his way, but you know, I think he might have become a drummer or something because of Doyle Bramhall's influence.
Yeah.
But, because I understand he was quite good at that as well, which doesn't surprise me at all.
No, it doesn't.
But I think the guitar, and especially the type of music and so on, I think Jimmy was just incredibly influential.
Yeah, bringing home those Hendrix records and those Cream records, and just incredible. And it's funny too; it's really interesting. I just saw Jimmy the other night, two nights in a row, and I'm actually
at the Jungle Show.
Yeah, and I'm actually going to go check him out again tonight over at Seaboys. And out of any guitar player that I can think of, he has said such a distinct maturation process, because if you go back to the very first, and I wish I would have seen him in the clubs or in the early days before being recorded, you know, when they were like the house band at Antone's. But those early recordings of the Thunderbirds, and then all the way up to what he's doing now, to his latest record, Baby Please Come Home. The maturation process is so distinct and so defined, and how he has changed. The other night, I mean, when I watched him play and heard him play, he was playing saxophone lines, you know.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
It was, I mean, there are some of the lines that he played stuck in my head like a pitchfork, and it was just, and I can't get them out of my head, and it was so so defined, and I just love the way he has become. To me now, you know, I mean, with BB gone, you know, and Eric Clapton kind of handing off the mantle in a way, I kind of feel like it's Jimmy's throne to be had at this point. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, he's always been one of my absolute favorite guitar players. And the first time I saw him was 1982. And I was just, blown away. It was just like, oh, my God, this guy's so incredibly good. And, you know, and he used to play the pedal steel, stand-up pedal steel, mm-hmm. and all kinds of stuff like that, mm-hmm. and some of the T-Bird shows, and you know, play things like Sleepwalk and so on, on that.
Yeah.
And, I was just amazed. And, you know, to a large extent, though, even on the first T-Bird record, he does have that economy and that style that he still has and has become very known for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like writers, you know, it's like Hemingway compared to Faulkner or Fitzgerald.
Yeah.
Just so succinct, but so right, you know, just absolutely. Exactly the right lines.
Absolutely. And speaking of going back to the idea of being in the right place at the right time, there is a great picture on page 27 that you took in November of 82 at Rockefeller's, of Jimmy with the guitar behind his neck, and he's got his foot up, and you can see the bottom side of his work boot, and
right.
What a killer shot. And this is, once again, this is when I talk about those iconic shots. This is one of those shots that you see a lot of times out and about, and people go, wow, that, what a cool shot. And oftentimes I'd go, I know who took that picture. And then you have a whole bunch of those shots of him, you know, doing the crawl, you know, playing the crawl, of him with the guitar behind his back. And they are just wonderful shots. Really just fantastic things. And
well, thank you.
Yeah. I mean, once again, the right place at the right time. I do have a picture. There's a picture here that I've seen. I don't know. I must have seen it 100 times in my life. It's with Buddy Guy at Antone's in March of 84, where Jimmy's kind of leaning in, and it looks like Buddy's either looking or listening to what Jimmy's playing, or they're saying something to each other. Do you know which it was? Because it looks like they're having a conversation.
Yeah, I think they're saying something to each other, because that was Antone's on Guadalupe.
Right.
And it was it was 10 days before Jimmy's birthday, but it was a birthday show for him, and Buddy Guy came in, and I think they're just like, well, what are we going to play next? So, you know, because they're just jamming on stage and so on.
It's so great. And then you've got all these great shots from Sea Boys, which are, you know, this is more of the times that I've got to see Jimmy play. And, you know, it's so funny. Every time I see him play, I kind of, you know, especially at Sea Boys, I make sure I stand right in front of him and watch everything he's doing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, and often enough, he looks at me. A couple of times, he's literally stuck the neck in my face. Like, okay, if you're going to watch, then watch here, you know, and then afterwards I'll say something to him like, you know, that was, you know, how in the world, you know, he goes, yeah, he goes, I see you watching. But yeah, I mean, and then all the other amazing folks that you have taken photos of, obviously we said Buddy Guy and Albert King, this amazing picture of Albert King here. Had you had any interactions with Mr. King?
Not really, and unfortunately, I only saw him that once. But I think, you know, I had told him that I had been introduced to his music basically through Stevie.
Right.
So, you know, what a great introduction, right?
Well, you know, a lot of people, I mean, even I heard Albert Collins say it. I even heard John Lee Hooker say it, that if it wasn't for Stevie and his willingness and his love of the blues, reintroducing it to a younger audience, it really helped a lot of these older blues players when they were revamping
yeah,
their career.
Very much so.
Yeah. Tell me about your first meeting, because I know you write about it here in the book. But tell us a little bit about your very first meeting with Stevie, because it's a adorable story. I love it.
Oh, okay. The reason I was sent to photograph him, it was by Public News, which was an independent music paper in Houston, and they said, hey, this guy Stevie Ray Vaughan, he's going to be on David Bowie's new record Let's Dance, and so we need to go get some pictures of him and interview him. And when I got to Fitzgerald's backstage there and met him, I think I said something to him along the lines of, well, you know, what, I don't know what those other photographers were doing, but you're really cute. Because, you know, it was just like, I've seen pictures of him that were just awful. And, you know, because, and I kind of blurted that out, but he was very pleased with that.
That's a great. I love that. So he took a shine to that.
Yes, very much so. Yeah.
That's great. And that was the same night that you did that those pictures with the effect that we talked about.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Cool. Yes, and you know, hearing the sound check and hearing him, you know, play. I think during the sound check he went into Little Wing, and I was just like, you know, I hadn't been old enough to photograph Hendrix, but I'd always wished that I could have, or could have even seen him. Mm-hmm. And you know, when Stevie started to play that, I was just like, oh my God, you know, it's just like channeling the spirit. So,
yeah, that's super cool.
Yes. It's like, well, you know, I'll photograph this guy because he's amazing, and you know, here's my chance. So.
Did you get the impression the first time you saw him play? And obviously, that had been the very first time you saw him play.
Right.
So, did you get the impression that evening, the very first time you heard him, that there was something unique, something different that was going to take him to another place? Obviously, by that point, he had done the that Bowie record, right?
Right.
Yeah. So did you get the impression that, because I've heard that from so many people, you know, I didn't get to see him in the early days. I only saw him in larger venues. So.
Well, here's the thing. You know, I'm kind of, strangely, like many people, I'm kind of cynical about the music business or about arts in general. And I thought he was incredible, but I didn't necessarily think that he was going to become as famous as he was, because, you know, think about the kind of music that was popular in 1983
right.
and 1984. Right. I mean, you know, you had stuff like Flock of Seagulls and things like that.
That's true. Duran Duran.
You know, there's some good Duran Duran songs, but basically, you know, it was just, you know, such an outside chance that somebody playing the blues and blues rock and heavily guitar oriented in a decade of synthesizers would get to be that popular. So
yeah.
It was what I would call an incredibly pleasant surprise to me.
It was the antithesis of really what was going on at the time. It really, really was.
Yeah.
And it was
And I remember reading some review that I can't remember who wrote it, of Texas Flood, the first album, and the first single, Pride and Joy. And the critics said, oh, it's just another blues shuffle. And I'm thinking, yeah, and we sure are hearing a whole lot of that on the radio right now, right? what a ridiculous criticism. You know,
that was
that kind of stuck in my head, because it really pissed me off.
Well, obviously, that was someone who was really enjoying Flock of Seagulls at that point in time.
Yes, clearly, yeah.
You know, and we totally understand the staying power of that now. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
There's a picture in the book, and I'm trying to figure out, I think I know who this might be, but it's page 45. It's Doyle Bramhall Sr. Is that a young David Holt?
Yes. I don't know. I haven't got the book up, and I don't know page by page.
Okay.
But it should be captioned. Yeah. It's the one that looks like.
Oh, right. Yeah, here it is. It is captioned. Yeah, it's David Holt at the Continental in 2008.
Yes.
Yeah, he looks so different here. he looks great. Another amazing guitar player.
Singer. And clearly underrated as well. Yeah.
Absolutely. And somebody, I loved him in Storyville, and just great stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Great stuff. So once again, you swing back to Stevie and the first purchase. A lot of people know that the very first record that he ever bought with his own money, that Jimmy didn't bring home, was a 45
right.
was a 45 of Lonnie Mack's Wham.
Yes.
Which Stevie did a barn burning version of. I see you have some amazing photos of Lonnie in the book as well. Tell us a little bit about that show. Do you remember much about that night?
Actually, no, I don't remember too much, but I do remember that, you know, I had remembered hearing the recordings when I was a kid, and then, you know, Stevie did produced and played on the record with Lonnie Mack, and you know, it's just went to see him, and I saw him several times, and just really loved his music and his playing. You know, you think about him and Albert King, and you wonder how come you didn't see Stevie with a flying V.
Yeah, I mean, anytime I saw him play, which was very, very, very infrequently, was at 335.
Right, yeah.
You know, it was always like, well, that it looks very uncharacteristic. You know, it was a very odd thing. I think I've seen one picture of him in all these years of him with a Les Paul, and that was very strange.
I know. I think there's some shots of him later on with B.B. King with that black Les Paul.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that he borrowed that from someone for that particular show.
Yeah. Yeah.
I never saw him with a Les Paul, and I don't know if he ever had one in his collection.
Yeah.
So I don't know whose guitar that was. And, you know, every time you see one of those pictures on Facebook or Instagram, I always make a comment, well, you know, whose guitar is that? What show is that?
Right.
And who took the picture? And no one ever answers those those comments. So I don't know.
Yeah, it's pretty weird. And then there was, I know there's a picture out there of him jamming with Carlos Santana, and it was definitely, he came out during Carlos's set, and he's playing some guitar that I've never seen him play either, and that was kind of odd. Speaking of cool guitars that we didn't get to see for a very long time, and I think really the only video of the guitar is the Live at Montreux. Is that that bright yellow rally yellow Strat with the one pickup in the neck?
Oh yeah, yeah.
You have some of the best photos ever of that guitar.
Well, thank you, thank you.
Because there weren't a whole lot of photos of that instrument, and seeing these in the book, I had never seen these particular shots from June 20, 1983. I've always been I've always been in love with this guitar. Matter of fact, I went ahead and I said, well, this is fascinating. You know, it's only one pickup, so it's really forcing you to make everything happen with this one pickup in the neck position. So I had to go and build one, so I did. And
yeah, and it was kind of hollowed out too, because what had happened, the guy from Vanilla Fudge had it, and he put humbuckers in it, and so when Charlie Wirtz took the humbuckers out, there, you know, it was pretty hollow.
Yeah.
So, and he fixed it up for Stevie and put that one pickup in.
Yeah. Well, you know, so, when they have a route in the body like that big, they usually call it a swimming pool.
Yeah. Well, you know, the swimming pool gave it a very distinct tone.
Oh,
so.
I'm sure it did. Absolutely. And you know, he plays it. He opens up the set at Montreux with that guitar. And I know that shortly after that, I think it was, that guitar was stolen. And then I heard through Guitar World magazine that it had been recovered and then donated to the Hard Rock and was in Las Vegas at the Hard Rock Hotel.
Right.
And so I was in Vegas about 2 years ago, about 2 years ago now. And so, of course, I had to make a Mecca to see if I could see the guitar up close. I searched high and low. They couldn't tell me. You know, I showed them pictures. They said, we don't know where it is. It's somewhere here.
Wow.
I literally went to every floor in the hotel trying to find the guitar, and I did not find the guitar. So I don't know for sure if it's there or not, but I would love to see it up close.
Oh, yeah, me too. I don't know, because, you know, they tore the Hard Rock Vegas down. And I don't know where that collection went to, but,
yeah,
you know, that's kind of that's kind of strange that nobody knew where it was.
Yeah.
Unless it got re-stolen or something.
Oh, goodness.
I hope not.
But yeah, you definitely nailed it as far as these are the best shots I've ever seen of this guitar. I wish I would have had these particular shots when I was making mine. This is because it's fantastic. It's so cool. Yeah. Yeah. And then those pictures of the 335 are just completely unique. Completely unique. I love it to death. So the size of this book, is this going to be like a coffee table size book?
Well, they don't really do that anymore.
Okay.
Not comparing myself to Ansel Adams, but the latest Ansel Adams books that came out, you know, the last year or two, the book size is about 10 by 10 or 10 and a half by 10 and a half. And that's the size my book is. And of course, hardcover. But, you know, the theory is from publishers that, well, people have, you know, their phones and their tablets, so they just like something that fits nicely in their hands that they can look at. So, mm-hmm. But, you know, it gives it it's a more intimate thing, and it gives people if you want to see it larger, well, go to an exhibit. So.
What was it like for the folks? I mean, obviously after your first encounter with Stevie, you probably started to go see him a little more often.
Right.
What was everybody's experience there, or here, I should say, here in Texas, but in Houston and in Austin? What was everybody's experience once Stevie went ahead and it kind of exploded in the rest of the world? You know, started to call him their own. What was it like for everybody back at home at that point?
Well, you know, I don't know exactly what you mean, but it, you know, pretty much the same as any musician who's homegrown somewhere and who people knew from smaller venues who then explodes. There are always people who say, oh, well, you know, I saw him in the old days, he was better, or whatever BS.
That is BS.
And then, of course, the fan base who just, you know, love him to death and will go to any show. And also a whole lot of new people because of the greater exposure of the records and the interviews he did with the magazines. And, of course, the guitar freaks who always come out.
Yeah.
All the guitar nerds and freaks. And it's just like, oh, man, how does he do that? So I don't think, you know, I think for the most part, everyone was really happy for him. And then when he started to, you know, get so heavily into drugs and drinking and started to decline physically and emotionally, there was a lot of the reaction of, oh, my God, he's going to be dead in like a month, which he almost was. Mm-hmm. And then when he started to play again after sobriety, most people were extremely happy for him, and there were people who said, oh, it's not going to last. And but, you know, his playing, he played with so much more clarity, and he was so much happier. So, you know, you couldn't help but be happy for him too.
Yeah, that was an interesting thing. Actually, friends from out of town came in for the Jungle Show, and we were all sitting around talking about all different people. And of course, inevitably, Stevie comes up in conversation when we start talking about Texas blues. And and you know, one of the things that a lot of us have always been and continue to be frustrated with was, here it was, he had finally gotten himself clean, and he was doing stuff that was high and above what he had ever done before. And you could tell there was this, you could hear it and you could feel it in the music. There was this incredible sense of joy in the music.
Mm-hmm.
And then he gets taken. you know, I do cling to that line in Six Strings Down, you know, see the voodoo child holding out his hand, been waiting on your brother, welcome to the band. That's the one thing that kind of gives me some solace in that. Okay, well, he's definitely in a better place, but boy, oh boy, to travel the road he had traveled and then to be taken that way.
Oh, I know. It's almost, you know, to get kind of philosophical and out there, but not really too much. It's almost like a Greek myth, because, you know, the hero's journey, because what he went through and how he almost died, and then, you know, he achieved so much and was like on this mission to bring this music to everyone, and this joy, this contagious joy to everyone, and then, you know, the helicopter crash, and you know, you think about the how it's got that mythology to it, and then to be taken in a place called Troy. That's, yeah, you know, crazy ironic.
Yeah, that is irony.
Horrible, yeah. But, you know, you to put it into that perspective, it's almost as if, you know, he was sent from somewhere else and you know, he had his brief time here to be with us and then moved on.
Yeah. So, as he started to get more popular and started to play larger venues, and you would end up doing photography in those larger venues, like in 87 at the Sam Houston Coliseum in Houston. What were the challenges there for you as a photographer? I mean, you know, being able to, I mean, even though you might have been in the pit, obviously it probably changes the way your approach, correct?
Well, it did as far as what kind of gear I used. You know, it's just like you use certain kinds of amps and setups in a club, and then when you go to a larger venue, of course, you use a different setup for that.
Yeah.
I had been using the Leica rangefinders, and their forte as a camera is with normal lenses or wide angle lenses, mm-hmm. and because of the viewing and the focusing system. And then when he started to play the larger shows, of course you need a different setup with like a short telephoto lens, like a 135 millimeter, mm-hmm. and very fast lens. And that's why I went to the Nikons, because they're better for that sort of larger venue, and really their thing is very fast lenses that are, you know, the telephoto ones and the short telephoto ones especially.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, you know, it's a different approach as far as the equipment goes, and not so much you know, as far as the actual shooting, because, you know, like you said, I was in the pit or right up front, and, you know, Stevie knew where I was, and he would tend to make it easy for me. You know, there's some shots from that show outside the Astrodome where, yeah, he's literally leaning into the camera.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, it was almost, I almost had to back up because he came so close, which is great.
I was actually just going to ask.
I never use zoom lenses, so, you know, I don't, no particular reason, just my style of shooting. And so you physically have to move back and forth in order to get the shot.
Right,
so,
right.
But you know, in fact, I was using a 180 millimeter telephoto, and I had to switch to the 135, which is, you know, not as, doesn't bring you as close because of the fact that he would do that, which was wonderful.
I was actually going to ask you about those shots outside the Astrodome. That's one of the reprints that I got at your showing at Antone's.
Yeah, that's the one where he's leaning into the camera, and bending the strings.
I mean, honestly, you would think that was a stage shoot. It's so perfect. Those photos are so perfect. That and once again, iconic shots. These are shots that people see all the time and tend to take it for granted. But you put the let's see, what page is this here? It's page 85 of the book. Is a contact sheet from there.
Oh,
it's so cool. All those different shots. I mean, I would love reprints of every single one of these. They're wonderful. They're really, really great. Yeah, I think that's super cool. So this was a show that they did outside the Astrodome.
Right. It was, and they did a show inside too, but I had to, this was something that will forever frustrate me. I didn't see Stevie's part of the show inside the Astrodome. Because I had the press credentials, I had to go to a conference with Randy Quaid talking about, putting the show together. So I only saw The Who, which they were the headliners inside the Astrodome. So that outside show, it was Jimmy Vaughn and Thunderbirds, and Joe Ely with David Grissom, mm-hmm. and Stevie, and it was, incredible show. So I didn't. I'm very thankful I got to shoot that, but I would have loved to have seen the indoor stuff as well.
Yeah. There's a shot from the Fire Meets the Fury tour that he did with Jeff Beck, which was a show I got to see as well in New York. You call that your Rembrandt shot.
Right, because the way the lighting is, and also the way he's dressed, it's almost like the guys on the Dutch Master cigar box.
Yeah. Yeah, or maybe even a gambler on a riverboat with a Strat.
Oh well, yeah.
Fantastic! Yeah, these just marvelous pictures, marvelous, really good. I can't wait to get my actual copy of the book. Right now, I'm looking at a digital version of it.
Me too. It's been a long gestation, an elephant having a baby. I think that it takes like 2 years for a baby elephant to appear.
Yeah, I hear you. It's funny, you and I have similar favorite songs. And you had mentioned earlier in the book about one of the songs that you love that Doyle Bramhall co-wrote, which was Change It.
Oh yeah,
that song has such an emotional quality to it. The performance, I mean, the song itself, but the performance. I mean, I've seen Doyle Bramhall II play it several times with different people, and it's very, you can tell there's a lot of emotion in the song, but the version off of Soul to Soul. The guitar solo on that is, the whole recording, but the guitar solo on that in particular is one that always really, really captures me. There's a moan to it. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, very much so. Yeah, like I said, it's got some similarities to Two Steps from the Blues.
Yeah.
Which is also one of my all-time favorite songs.
Yeah, the Bobby Blue Bland, yeah.
Yeah, but there's just something about it, that hold your breath quality to it.
Mm-hmm.
And, I love that song. It's just an amazing song.
Yeah. I, I, think it's really, it's been very interesting since his passing to see what everybody who were in his world or in his sphere, that they've all gone and done, you know, obviously with the, obviously what Tommy and Chris did with Archangels, which was, I wish there would have been more because it was really a wonderful, I mean, really it was like an Austin supergroup.
As was Storyville,
absolutely, for sure. And the songs that they gave us were just wonderful, but they were, you could tell that everybody really kind of wanted to, they didn't want to get caught up in that trip, because I know that, and I've spoken to Doyle about this second, about the fact that, you know, he did not want to get caught up in that whole idea of, okay, well, you're next, so now you got to be this blazing guitar player, which he is.
As is Charlie,
you know, and David and all those other guys.
Right.
But they all found their, I love the fact that they've all found their own voice, and their voices are completely unique, which is really, really lovely. I mean, like the last Doyle Bramhall record, to me, and the last, I mean, for 2018, that was my record for 2018. There was no other record that could come close to that record, the Shades record. It's phenomenal. It's still a record that I play over and over and over again, and every time, that's, to me, is the proof of a really great record, is that every time you hear it, you hear something different, you know. And what Charlie has done with, you know, as a musical director, as a songwriter, as a producer, and, you know, where his work with Bob Dylan, you know, is just enormous. It really, really is. And to see them all work through their demons and work through their stuff, and to see where they've come out is really amazing. Ian Moore is another great example.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, Ian is someone that I started seeing him play just right before and right after August 1990, and watched him play with Joe Ely and come into his own and his own band and first couple of records and more. And, you know, it's he got... handed that mantle of next Stevie Ray Vaughan or right. next Guitar Hero, and he managed to overcome that in some ways and just become an incredible songwriter and singer.
Yeah.
He's got a tremendous voice.
Yeah.
And it's because it's got to be very limiting as an artist for somebody to say you're the next so-and-so.
Yeah.
No matter how much you love and respect that person. I mean, you know, Stevie didn't want to be the next Jimi Hendrix. So, you know, same thing.
Right. Exactly. You know, and the same thing for what's happened for Gary Clark Jr.
I was just going to say, we haven't mentioned Gary Clark Jr.
I mean,
and speaking of great records, you know, his latest album, This Land, there's so much on there, you know, and he goes from the Marvin Gaye thing to, you know, almost reggae and so on.
That record.
And blues, too.
Yeah, that record, that was our number one record for 2019 here at Guitar Radio Show. For us, we looked at that record and saying, okay, it finally happened. We've been waiting for someone to take the blues and this, or rhythm and blues, or soul music, you know, American music, to the next level. And he found the formula, if you will. I mean, I don't know if it's a formula so much as it's a quest. You know, and
yeah,
also
it's a manifesto.
And also created a statement with it as well.
Very much so.
Definitely the best record of the year. If it doesn't win a Grammy, I just don't understand. I mean, that's just bizarro to me. You know, but it is far and away the best record, I think, of the year. And it's that's another one of those records that just keeps on delivering every time I hear it, you know. And then, you know, and then the work he's doing, you know, playing him and Eric Zapata, King Zapata, playing off of each other. Another great guitar player from Austin.
Yes.
You know, and then, you know, and then Eric Tesmer and his EP too, which was such an incredible leap in maturity, songwriting, and his voice. How the heck, where did that voice come from?
Well, it just came from his passion for the music, I think. And also, you know, that album, the song Good So Bad.
Yeah.
That's, you know, about his quest for sobriety.
Yes.
And so on. That obviously, you know, Stevie was a great example for that, and especially for Eric. But it changes many things as far as what you said about maturity and about and vocals and so on. And that's been something that's been huge for Eric is his sobriety over the last few years.
He and I sat down, we had a 2.5-hour conversation during South By, or just before South By, and to talk about the record, and we went track by track, and he's in such a great place. I mean, I remember seeing him in the early day, him in his early days at the Saxon, when he had that residency at the Saxon Pub, and he would do some crazy stuff, man, let me tell you, and, you know, just ripping the strings out of the guitar, and just, you know, crazy stuff. And I was always amazed by the fire in him, but how he's gone ahead now and harnessed that fire into this incredibly mature musician who just has so much to say. I can't wait to see what's going to come next from him. I really can't.
Oh yeah. Well, he's done a recording with Nancy Wilson that's going to come out sometime, probably around the time my book comes out.
Yeah, I can't wait. I can't wait.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. That's going to be good. And just to see him get more recognition because, you know, again, the thing with the music business, just because you have an amazing amount of talent doesn't mean you're going to make it.
No. I mean, I can name...
quote, unquote, make it.
Yeah, exactly.
Be able to support yourself and so on and so forth. Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's not like the old days when the T-Birds would get, you know, red beans and rice and some chicken necks and that was their pay. You know, you could make it work. It doesn't work like that anymore. The cost of living is a very different. It's a different scene.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You know, but I got to tell you, I as I just scroll through here, it's such, these pictures are just so rich and so lush, and you've done an amazing job with this book, and I think it's wonderful. I really do.
Thank you.
And I can't wait to get my copy. Do you think you're going to be? I know you're going to be doing the exhibit in March 14th, at Photo Fest exhibit.
That's the opening.
Yep, at Antiquarium and Gallery, Antiquarium Gallery in Houston on March 14th. Will you be coming to Austin to do something?
Probably in April.
Okay.
Because you know just. Not having the absolute guarantee of a bunch of books in March, you know, I don't think I'm going to do South by Southwest, although that might be an impromptu pop-up or something, but I am looking to do something in April.
Okay.
So.
Well, very cool. Well, I'll be there.
Great.
I will be.
Appreciate that. Yeah, bring for sure. Bring lots of friends.
I will do it. I will absolutely do it. Folks, you got to check out this book. It's called Seeing Stevie Ray. It's going to be on University Press. You can pre-order it now.
Yeah, it's Texas A&M University Press.
Okay,
Texas A&M. I was going to say to interrupt you. You can pre-order at Texas A&M University Press's website and at Amazon and Barnes and Noble and all of those places.
Cool. So, and folks, I'll have all those links in the show notes at GuitarRadioShow.com. You can also go to HeightsGallery.com for more information regarding the book.
And I have actually the stuff that's more current on events and so on is my Instagram page.
Okay.
And that's also the Heights Gallery.
Perfect. So, which I follow you on that.
Yeah, I know. But that's, you know, because of the nature of Instagram, it's just more current. In fact, like a lot of people, I tend to slightly neglect my website because of the immediacy of Instagram.
Right.
There's probably quite a bit more on that.
Ah, the world of instant gratification. That's great. Well, I can't thank you enough. Once again, thanks for coming on the show. This is your second time, and I haven't had a photographer on since you.
Oh, well, I appreciate that, and I very much appreciate being on the show.
Well, you're part of the Guitar Radio Show family now at this point, so anytime you want to come on and chat with us, we're happy to have you.
Okay, well, thank you, Mark.
All right. Once again, folks, the book is called Seeing Stevie Ray by Tracy Ann Hart. Go pre-order this, get it. And if you're in Austin in April and she's around, come to the signing. I'll be there for sure. If you're in Houston on March 14th, 2020, Photo Fest exhibit at Antiquarium Gallery in Houston. Thanks again. Hold on 1 second, but we're going to sign off right here.
Okay.
Check out Guitar Radio Show on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Stitcher Radio, GuitarRadioShow.com, and anywhere you get your podcasts. Find Guitar Radio Show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And remember, if you like the artists you hear on Guitar Radio Show, don't just stream their music, buy it. GRS Group.